Guys, if you can hire samurai to risk their lives and save your village for the low, low price of 3 bowls of rice a day, can you imagine what they would do in exchange for Sparkplug coffee? Sparkplug isn't like the regular still coffee you find at the grocery store or your local cafe. Sparkplug is made from premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer lots of blends and roasts to choose from, including decaf and half-calf. But what really sets Sparkplug coffee apart is that each order of premium coffee is delivered to your home or office within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Fresh roasted beans truly make the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top
100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Konnichiwa, film freaks, and arigato for popping play on the next 100 project. After 2.5 years of reviewing AFI movies, now we talk about a random assortment of titles. If you are listening to this before watching the movie itself, be careful because we are known to spoil things. I'm that Ronin, Ryan Ellis, and with me as always is my bandit-battling wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Seven Samurai, or Shishinin no Samurai. And we're going to botch a lot of names and pronunciations in podcast. Let's own up to that right now. But okay, here it is. Which director-actor combination teamed up most often? Martin Scorsese and Bob De Niro, Ingmar Bergman and Max von Sydow, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon, or Akira Kurosawa and Toshiro Mifune?
Impressively, it was Kurosawa and Mifune who did 16 films together.
Very true.
All those combinations that you listed did a lot of work together. Mm-hmm. Woody Allen and Mia Farrow made 13 films together. I did not realize that.
Before he messed it all up by banging her daughter.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Bergman and Von Sydow had 11 together. Scorsese and De Niro, 8, but nothing since Casino, so 21 years and counting. Wilder and Lemmon did 7. But here's the record that I could find anyway. There's probably some lesser-known combinations in the history of films, but of major players, John Ford and John Wayne, 21 movies together.
Wow.
But I didn't include them because I wanted number one to be the subjects of this week's picture, Kurosawa and Mifune, with 16. All right, the next 100 Project's 27th movie, Seven Samurai, was released in Japan by Toho in April of 1954. After the movie brought in mucho yen over there, Columbia imported it to Hollywood in July 1956, so that makes it 60 years ago, just a few months ago. Bev, explain the movie for those who aren't familiar with this game.
A Japanese farming village in 1586 is attacked by bandits who steal their food. The villagers recruit the title characters to fight back.
Also known as A Bug's Life. Or, in a nutshell, it's the A-Team in the Orient. Alright, the numbers first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics love this picture. 100% of them, 57 fresh, all loved the picture, or at least liked the picture. And 97% of audiences, some of the strongest scores we've ever seen. It is also 19th on the IMDb's 250. That's one of the strongest scores we've ever seen there. Although Japanese critics didn't think very highly of it back in the 50s. And that's the same deal with a movie we covered a few months ago, Empire Strikes Back. That's one that's gained in esteem. It was not disliked, neither was Seven Samurai, but just liked even more now. Few more critical numbers. Sight and Sound. We haven't talked about them in a while. The director's poll had this movie 10th in both 1992 and 2002, and the critic's poll had it 3rd in 1982, and it just missed the top 10 in 2002. What does Bev think about what has been called the first modern action movie?
The first hour drags. It has some really great stuff, but until the samurai are gathered and headed towards a village, watching this movie feels a little like doing homework. But once they get to that village, boy howdy, it gets going.
Boy, howdy.
I will take this entire podcast to address all the things that make this a masterpiece and all the ways that Kurosawa was a technical genius, near perfect. But I'll take this opportunity just to say how beautiful, affecting, and really thought-provoking this film is. It doesn't just entertain and impress, it gives you a gut punch, which is made more phenomenal when you consider not just the cultural divide it overcomes, but its age, which is... Well, it's over 60 years old.
Mm-hmm. But in America, it is about 60 years old. Part of what makes the movie work, our heroes suffer real loss, unlike the Star Wars movies or Lord of the Rings or most modern action flicks where the people we care about survive. The Seven is down to 3 when this is over, And they know that they've lost, even though they won the battle, because as Kanbei, the main character, played by Takashi Shimura, he even says to one of his buddies who has survived, the real winners are the farmers.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting ending, even though the farmer spends much of the movie lamenting their state in life. And in the 16th century in Japan, there was a pretty strong caste system that if you were born a farmer, you were a farmer. Samurai was a caste. And apparently Kurosawa was a descendant of samurai caste.
Mm-hmm.
But while they spend so much of the movie lamenting that poor social status, in the end, the farmers will probably never have to fight like that again. The survivors can carry on with their lives and put that behind them. They'll certainly never be asked to risk their lives for someone else's welfare. Even though the samurai, that's absolutely what they'll have to do. As a matter of fact, if they want to eat again, that is their lot in life, to continue risking their lives until they are one of the unlucky ones.
I'm going to quote Lethal Weapon yet again, one of the great lines in movies that no one really likes to quote but me, but Mel Gibson says it. It's the only thing I was ever good at, meaning killing people in Vietnam.
Mm.
He's a great warrior. These guys fit that bill, too. All they have is being great at being warriors, and that's why he knows they're going to lose in the end. Although, the funny thing is, there'll always be need for war. Even if the human species survives another 1,000 years or 10,000 years, there's still going to be war. There's still going to be a need for samurai, ronin, and just regular old warriors in the modern world. Well, the future world, I should say.
And you say this is the birth of action films, but most action films gloss over violence. Sorry, they glamorize.
They do. They really do.
They glamorize violence. They make it look instant and painless. And, you know, somebody blows up, you don't see them again. Or the people that blow up are not real characters. They
don't
have names.
See blood.
You don't
we
see
don't
blood.
We don't see the consequences of shooting a gun.
And many characters in the movie die, but each death is felt. Even if it happens off screen, there's nothing glorious about that moment of death. The violence is dirty and it's painful. And you even pity the bandits when they die. When that guy's being dragged by the horse through the mud, you're not taking pleasure in the fact that he's going to come to a violent end. And the way he dies is exactly the same as our hero. I'll say it wrong, but I'll say he's the imposter Kikuchiyu.
I think it's Kikuchiyo.
Yeah, he's
that's
the Mifune.
Mifune,
the guy who is an imposter of samurai and the id of the group and certainly
comic relief
in many ways. But when he dies, it's gruesome. He dies killing a bandit, and then he's just face first in the mud with his naked butt getting rained on.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to watch, and he dies exactly the same as the bandits. It works, in effect, to illustrate a microcosm of war. Like, it's this miniature war. It is a battle between two factions, but it's small enough that you can learn the names of most of the main players so that you personally care about who dies. But in many ways, it mimics a war film. They have a strategy that they work out. They have that great structure where you see Kanbei periodically crossing out the number of bandits who have died and talking about exactly what they're going to do so that you understand. One of the great things about this film, one of the things that Kurosawa does amazingly, is he keeps everything really, really coherent, even though it's chaotic. But that, and again, is like an illustration of war. On a small, small level.
You keep saying war, and we're about 10 years away in the mid-50s from Japan being a major player in World War II and being defeated with nuclear weapons in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We also talked about how Kikuchiyo and some of the other ones were killed. Well, of the four samurai, the bandits never kill any of them unless they use a gun. The more modern way of killing people, I guess you could say, as we get into the end of the 16th century, rather than using a sword like all these guys do.
And they acknowledge very much that that gun gives the bandits a huge advantage, and it's something that they have to consider when they're strategizing.
Also, having horses gives them a big advantage.
And that might be, I guess, like the Americans.
It's probably some kind of play on that. I mean, not every foreign film is ever going to dwell on what America had been doing for decades at that point, the imperialism that they've shown, or even the British, who were before the Americans and doing that same thing, or the Romans, hundreds of years before that, who had some of the same kinds of tactics and same kind of weapons, back in their time at least. But it's probably some kind of comment by an intelligent person like Kurosawa, who was the writer, or at least a co-writer, and the director, and the editor on this picture. He had such creative control.
But he certainly is never accused of being critical of the Americans. As a matter of fact, he was a great student of American films and was accused by the Japanese of making films too much to appeal
right.
to Westerners.
Yeah, he wasn't enough like Ozu, one of his contemporaries. He was making Tokyo Story, one of the Sight and Sound's most popular pictures from a few years ago, the 2012 poll. Wasn't that number one or two or three or something on both the director and critic poll? Ozu's style is very placid. the camera just sits there and films everything. I don't think he ever moved his camera. But Kurosawa is one of the few directors in the 50s, overseas at least, that was this dynamic. And really one of the few directors anywhere, including in America, that moved his camera this much, that had the ability, kind of like Orson Welles did, and a few other directors too were as good as this, but to show that depth of field, to have that kind of space, to have that kind of action, as we said, a modern action film. The modern action film was partly because of the thing of building your team. The very faithful 1960 remake, the Western, Magnificent Seven, John Sturges did that. We talked about that when we did The Great Escape, because he did that picture before The Great Escape. Watching Seven Samurai this time, I have not seen it in a long time. I'd forgotten some major details about it. Magnificent Seven has such a similar arc, including things like a guy is found chopping wood just to make a little bit of money. Bronson does that in the remake. And that's in Seven Samurai, and so many other beats they're in there, including only having three people survive, the main character being one of them, Kanbei in Seven Samurai, and Yul Brynner in Mag 7.
Wasn't Magnificent Seven just a straightforward remake of Seven Samurai?
Yeah, I'm just saying it's very faithful, because a lot of remakes are not very faithful. This one took a lot of the same elements, a ton of them. When I read a few Seven Samurai reviews, they commented about how Mag 7 was a lesser film. But I've seen that one more times than I've seen this one. And it's very similar. It's kind of the same movie, but in English, instead in the West, with Bronson and Brenner and McQueen, James Coburn, those guys. But the characters in Seven Samurai are based on actual samurai. And I didn't know what you said a minute ago, that Kurosawa's got samurai blood, or had. He's, of course, dead now. Well, he wanted to do, I think, a day in the life of a samurai.
Yes.
And then it became this whole story instead. And some of the major themes that come out of this, kind of a Japanese thing, I think, is fair to say, honor and shame. We see an awful lot of that. Shino, the daughter, there's a shame thing. She dares to love one of the samurai, and it suggests that when it's over that she's going to end up with him.
And there was a crossing of castes as well, which in 16th century Japan was a very big deal. Perhaps even a better example would be the samurai that go and take the guns. The first one is the, I'll call him the master swordsman, rather than muck up his name.
It's Kyuzo.
Kyuzo.
K-Y-U-Z-O. So I think it's Kyuzo.
So Kyuzo successfully kills a couple bandits and steals one of their guns, and he's a hero, and everybody praises him. And then the student, the...
Oh, Katsuhiro.
Yeah. Thank you.
The apprentice.
The apprentice, thank
My
you.
My young apprentice.
He's so impressed by Kyuzo that he wants to do the exact same thing, but nobody tells him to, so he has to kind of sneak off and do it, which he succeeds. He kills a bandit, and he steals a gun, which is great, but while he does that, the people that he was supposed to be looking after get killed by the bandits, and right. He gets torn a new one by Kanbei. Because it's not honorable when you go off on your own and for your own aggrandizement, you do this thing because you want to be a hero. No, you don't want to be a hero. You don't want to do things for individuality. You do things for the better of the group, and you follow the rules. You follow your orders.
Without that very last part you said in that little speech, that's exactly what Kanbei says. He doesn't say you have to follow orders, but he does say this is about teamwork. If we don't work as a team, we're going to lose. They only win, I would say, because they managed to team up and defeat the bandits. But they also do some pretty terrible things. They have some premeditated attacks, which become premeditated murder on the bandits.
I don't know. You know the bandits are going to attack. They are your enemy. So is it really because there's women there? Because there's women in the village as well that are going to starve to death if the bandits... Or get stolen and turned into concubines like the farmer's wife.
Who walks back into the burning hut. I guess
shame.
It's suggested that she's going to just let herself burn up, which is an awful suggestion.
Yeah, but that's a great illustration
Honor
of shame.
And shame.
Yeah, her life is ruined. She can't go back to her old life, even though her husband is devastated that she's been taken away from him and would probably, under any other circumstances, happily take her back. But because social mores are so important in 16th century Japan, that is how that story has to play out.
That's part of the problem with the paranoid and hypocritical villagers, or the farmers. Both Seven Samurai and Magnificent Seven play off this, where the villagers, the farmers, are hiding when the guys first get there, and then Horse Buckles in the 1960 remake, and this one it is Mifune, are ringing a bell to bring everyone out and pointing out, you jerks called us here, and yet you hide when we show up as if we're going to rape you on sight.
But speaking of Mifune, he has one of my favorite parts of the film, because I thought it was kind of silly that the villagers overreacted as bad as they did. Until Mifune has a speech after the samurai give him a hard time over celebrating getting some other samurai's armor. He starts ripping on them about everything the farmers have been through and how the samurai have absolutely been their enemy up to this point and ruining their lives and all the warfare that was going on in Japan during the 16th century and what that did to these people.
A different kind of bandit.
Yeah, and why they had every right to mistrust the samurai, to be afraid of them and to treat them like garbage and never trust them. It's a really beautiful, passionate speech that he makes. And his whole performance is a little hyperbolic, although it doesn't bother me. It's overkill, I suppose, but he has so much charisma on screen.
Oh, yeah.
You 100% forgive it, and as a matter of fact, you find it very entertaining. But I loved that speech. I actually found that pretty moving, his reaction to them.
He's a Kabuki-esque over-actor in this picture, and I guess in a lot of Kurosawa's movies he was. Much like Klaus Kinski, who worked with Herzog so much, was an over-actor in a lot of ways, but was a powerful screen presence. So you forgive a lot of the overacting because it works. Nicholson in The Shining is overacting, and people have commented on that forever, as he did in so many movies, actually. But it seems to work, just like Mifune works in this picture. I love the way he carries his sword. I had actually had a list of 50 of my favorite things in movies ever, and most of them were not the obvious ones. And one of them was the way he walks around with that sword over his shoulder. It's not the way anyone else carries their sword. I've never seen a sword carried like that in any other movie other than maybe as an homage to this one. And he's got such great energy, too.
Apparently, Kurosawa liked to tell his actors to pick idiosyncratic tick or just repeated motion that they would do all the time. I wonder if that was something he did. A great example that would also be Kenbei rubbing his head all the time, every time he's being thoughtful.
His Shane from Walking Dead-esque rubbing his head.
He liked that they repeated gestures because it set their characters apart, but it also could convey emotion.
And people do that. If you have some kind of tick, you're probably going to do it without knowing you're doing it in life. So why wouldn't these guys do it? We're seeing a short version of their lives, although this movie's not short, 3.5 hours long. But you see Kanbei's hair grow back, too. The opening, when we first meet him, his recruiting mission takes quite a while because his hair does grow back to be at least stubbly after it is fully shaved off in the opening sequence. A few people have pointed this out, including Roger Ebert, that in that opening sequence, it's one of the first times, if not the first time, a movie had shown a Bond-esque kind of unrelated to the plot kind of moment to show who we're dealing with.
Which is incredible when you think that there was even a first time for this to happen. It's so cliche in action movies that I think you could safely say that that is a blueprint of action films. Now, I think it's rare to find an action film that doesn't start with some independent adventure that the hero is on to introduce them.
No, what actually is happening more often now is something that happens about an hour into the movie and we see that scene and then 6 months ago and then we catch up. That's become more standard than the Bond-esque or Seven Samurai-esque unrelated to the main plot action sequence.
Okay, so that's a variation on the same technique, but it still is kind of dropping the audience into the action without a lot of introduction. Like, that's how you get to know the character, is by watching them do a similar task that's unrelated to the main plot of the film.
But just showing Kanbei's honor at cutting off his bun, too. That's a big thing for a ronin or a samurai to have that. But he does it just so he can be incognito to be a priest. Goes in there, and we don't even see what happens when he kills that bandit in the beginning of the film, or that thief. Whatever it is, that thief, yeah. The guy just stumbles out slow motion. Another thing that Kurosawa did, which was not common back then, a slow motion death scene. 2 or 3 times, at least in this movie. Definitely 2. You see people dying in slow motion. We don't see how Kanbei got him, but obviously he somehow stuck him with a sword, I guess. Very smart, too. You see just the effect of how good he can be at this, but also has a certain amount of humility. It's not like he walks out there strutting, I'm the man. It's more like, well, I got the job done, so okay, that's enough of that.
And it's wisdom as well. You know, there's the samurai who's a great swordsman, but Kanbei is wise. He always knows the cleverest way to go about accomplishing a task and being successful.
He's Hannibal from the A-Team.
Even the A-Team.
Kanbei was influential in many ways, especially on George Lucas. Yoda was partly based on him, with the wisdom, the gestures, the groaning, kind of thing, where he's always thinking about something and then letting out that kind of groan. Lucas also stole dialogue from this movie, where the farmers say early on, we're made to suffer, it's our lot, where the line in Star Wars by 3PO is, we're made to suffer, it's our lot in life. It's almost the exact same line. Lucas is a huge fan of Kurosawa in general. I guess Hidden Fortress, I've never seen that one. It's a Kurosawa film that influenced the droids as secondary players who are actually the most important people. Well, not people, but the most important players in the whole story.
And I think the design of Darth Vader is based on a character in the Hidden Fortress.
Getting back to a point you just made, too, about the armor that Kiku Chiyo finds, and they all start very slowly but surely adding it to their own repertoire of clothing, because most of them just wear the clothes they came with for the longest time. That's something that's also done in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. that Nicholson, when he first gets to the mental ward, is wearing his black leather jacket, the black wool cap. But as the movie goes on at Cuckoo's Nest, very slowly but surely, he becomes like the rest of them until at the end he's dressed exactly like everybody else in the pure white clothes. In other words, he's being very slowly assimilated and defeated in that film. In this one, they're not being defeated, but they don't wear the armor that he finds. They're mocking him for even bothering with it. But as the battles go on, all of them seem to be wearing this stuff very smartly, because if you want to defend yourself against people that have horses and muskets, and also swords, wear armor. And as for the fighting in the film, it's very well done, very stylized a lot of the time, but it's also down in the muck. There's just nothing but mud and water. They shot some of those sequences when it was winter in Japan, so the actors and the director himself, I was reading, were just freezing in the mud and the water from all the, I guess, rain towers. Not that they actually had rain, per se.
You can see their breath in a lot of those shots. It must have been not digital. Miserable. Mifune said he had never been colder in his entire life.
And he's barely wearing anything. Oh, his including nothing bare from the waist ass. Down.
Like a whole hour of the film, he's not wearing pants.
Mm-hmm. And at the end, we see the disposability of soldiers, because they're ignored when the fighting is over. We see this in modern life. When soldiers come back, certainly Vietnam, this was true. Baby killers, all that kind of stuff. It wasn't just that they were accused of doing things over in Vietnam that were awful, but they were just put up to pasture, like they're the horse that ran the race, and then now you can go stud, but we don't care about you anymore, just go away. And this movie has the same kind of underlying thing, too, that obviously Kanbei picks up on. We don't matter anymore to these people, and they're not even noticed. They're not waved at as the movie's over. A lot of movies would probably end that way. Magnificent Seven does the same thing. These guys are talking, and the Katsuhiro is very slowly but surely joining the farmers group. But at first, there's the three of them talking about how, hey, our four comrades are dead in that hill. We see the giant mounds for graves up on that hill. And nobody's looking over at these guys saying, thanks a lot, bye. They don't count anymore.
I think it's another expression of the warts and all version of war. You know, we talked about the filth and the pain and of the violence and depiction. There's nothing glorified about that. And then they don't have the glory of the warriors at the end. The fact is, people in general are not actually that kind to warriors. You know, when the heat of the battle is over and everybody's grateful, you hoist them on your shoulder, you throw a ticker tape parade, whatever it is. But then once you get back to business and you don't need them anymore, then you don't want them anymore. You don't want these people in your life. They make the point over and over again, samurai aren't people that you want around your village. They take your women or they start fights or they act like jerks. They throw their weight around. It's just not a good influence to have around these placid farmers.
Or they're just mouths to feed, and if they're not going to serve a purpose anymore, if they're not needed for security, then why bother? However, the remaining samurai, the two of them, I guess it is, actually, because Katsuhiro does stay behind, they better stay close. Another warlord is going to fill that void. Somebody's going to take this village because it's takeable. The unending cycle of violence, too. Is it really over when the movie's over?
Yeah, it's true. Will they never need the samurai again? Those bandits may get replaced with another group of bandits.
I think they will.
Although, you have to wonder why the bandits don't give up on it. I think it's probably because they had their village set on fire at the beginning, mm-hmm. so there's like an honor part of it. They can't leave a task unfinished. They have to finish what got started with these people, because otherwise it would be running away, it would be cowardly, it would be against the Japanese code of honor.
A few different reviews I read point out that they're also playing their roles. We talked about how it's the caste system and everybody's got to do what they're supposed to do. The bandits are bad guys. They wouldn't look at it this way, but they've got to be bad guys. We have to raid the village because we have to raid the village. We're supposed to. This is part of our whole deal. That might be a little bit silly, but it's also an artistic statement that Kurosawa was making, maybe more than reality. But it's also one of those things where they may be, and we never see scenes with them back in their little encampment discussing it and saying, well, I'm going to, Curly or Moe or Larry, let's get them tomorrow, the exact same approach. We're going to finally defeat them. They should realize they're not going to, but they are just insistent, and maybe they think they have a different strategy. We just don't see what their strategy is. It doesn't work, but they come close. They do manage to kill a few of the samurai, too, so it's not like they completely lost. Well, they did lose, but they were drawing blood, even though we don't see blood in the film. They were making headway. It's actually funny how long we go in the movie without seeing the villains. More than 2 hours. We see them at the very beginning, and we don't see them ever again until about that 2 hour mark in what is a 3.5 hour film.
I like that, though, because it gives them an opportunity to explore the antsiness of war, because they're all waiting for the battle to happen, and they're all just going insane with anticipation, and they talk about how they all get horny and they want a woman, and then they are losing their minds because they never know when the bandits are going to come, even when they know it's too early for the bandits to come because it doesn't make sense. The barley hasn't been harvested yet. There's no reason for the bandits to come yet. They're already so nervous with anticipation. I like that. I feel like that's another accurate representation of what would happen in war.
This job, being a soldier back then or now, I'm not trying to compare to what these guys have to go through by any means, but I can relate to this one part of it and what I do. So much of my job is hurry up and wait. There's nothing happening. Nothing. No, do something now!
Because he's in the news, for the record, to listeners. They know.
So you're not actually doing anything for the longest time, but when you need to, it's react right this second. These guys would be the same deal, where it's, let's have the watch 24 hours. Nothing happened tonight. Nothing happened the next day, or the day after that. But then suddenly, months later, finally, there's something to do, and you better be ready when that time comes. It's hard to stay sharp, but that's the job. Stay sharp even when nothing's happening.
A lot of soldiers complain that the job is acres of boredom broken up by the occasional terror.
Jarhead gets that right, I would say. The Jake Gyllenhaal movie from 2005, directed by Sam Mendes.
Yeah, they never have that release in Jarhead.
Because that's all about the first Iraq War, where there wasn't really that much fighting for the American soldiers to do on the ground. They pushed Iraq out of Kuwait pretty fast, and then they show in that movie, at least, of course, it's not a documentary or anything, but they show that Jake Gyllenhaal and his guys are just training and training and training, and then nothing ever happens. Three Kings also points that out.
And they're disappointed that they don't get to fight. As a woman, I never can relate to that bloodlust. So I found that film surprising and super interesting because I don't think a lot of films really deal with that particular part of war. It's not really something you see a lot. Films focus on the action. They don't focus on the boredom and the anticlimactic part of being a soldier.
When you were that well trained, you want to use your skills. And in those two films, and probably other films too, this one, Seven Samurai, points it out at least at times. They do get that big release at the end, as do the Three Kings characters. Battleground, a movie from, I think, 1949, American film, is about soldiers being stuck in the cold and the mud, the damn snow, just beating down on them in the middle of winter over in Europe. And that so much of that job is just surviving, let alone trying to actually fight a war against your enemy. All right, we don't really know the cast that well. We won't talk about too many of the actors, but we've already mentioned Mifune and how good he was in the film. Well, he's up at the top, but he's good still. He said this was a favorite of his own films, and we talked about how much he worked with Kurosawa, but he's notably in Rashomon and Throne of Blood. Rashomon was almost the movie we did in this slot instead of Seven Samurai, and that would have been a great choice because that's an influential film beyond belief, too. That was 1950. That one's all about, if people haven't seen it, the different perspectives on how people view an incident. In that case, it's a supposed rape, supposed murder, but really was it a rape or a murder? And then Throne of Blood, if you haven't seen it, is an adaptation of Macbeth, and a pretty damn good one, too. Great death scene from what they call him, but the guy who plays Macbeth. I guess it's Mifune that plays him, but anyway, the character, whatever they call him in Throne of Blood. I always remember that because they just fill him with arrows, and you think, how did they do that in 1957? But it is very convincing. And then the main character is Kanbei, Takashi Shimura. What do you think of his performance? Because he's the opposite of Mifune. He's very dialed down and very ordinary for the leader of the group.
I thought he was wonderful. You know, for 1954, the performances are phenomenal. Like we said, some of them are exaggerated, but they all have this amazing energy, whether it's the manic energy of, say it for me, please, Mifune.
Kukichiyo.
Yeah, of him, or the very calm and commanding energy of Kanbei.
Mm-hmm. And then Gorobei, his second in command, has some good scenes too. The movie is well directed, of course, by Kurosawa, who was only ever nominated for one movie as Best Director. That was Ron in 1985. He won an honorary award, I think it was 1990. He uses depth of field and depth of focus, I guess you could say, very well. And when you have six and sometimes seven people, because so much of the time, especially early on, Kikuchiyo is the camera, so to speak. He's standing and berating them, and you cut to them, the six of them, just kind of calmly listening to his crap. And at first not putting up with it till they realize, all right, fine, come along. There's another thing that's in Magnificent Seven. Horst Buchholz refuses to not go along with them. It's going to be the sixth samurai. And then finally he's following them, and he's ahead of them at one point, which I think also Kikuchiyo does. And they finally just do this gesture, and again, in a podcast, which you could see this, but I love the gesture that Yul Brynner has at one point in that, where it's just, all right, come on, big wave of the arm, and he just joins them. And it seems to be the same way with Mifune, although I think his actual convincing moment is not even on the trail. It's when he gets there, they get there, I should say, and he gets up and he rings the bell to say, why are you people hiding from us? Because we're here to help you out.
So if we're going to talk about Kurosawa's directing, though, we haven't really focused that much on what makes him an incredible director, and he is technical master. You mentioned earlier in the podcast that he's a very dynamic director. He includes a lot of motion in his shots, and they're beautifully, perfectly choreographed. He's dynamic in his film directing the way Beethoven is dynamic in his compositions, in that it's incredible, and there's tons of energy, and there's so much going on, and it's very complex, but it's also perfect. There's just this mastery and this genius to it that is rare. And it was incredibly influential. I mean, he was very heavily influenced by John Ford, who's another master as a technical director. His action directing, as one of the early action directors, is so comprehensible. Like, the visual comprehension in the way that he makes shots quick, and there's lots of stuff going on, but he always knows exactly how long to hold a shot or exactly what to show you so that you can comprehend what's happening, which a lot of action directors don't do.
Most.
I find some action movies really boring because I just can't keep up what's happening on the screen. And he has battle scenes where he's following three different stories and he's cross-cutting and there's horses' legs and there's mud and you can't tell who's who, and yet still you know exactly what's going on. You know at what point in the battle they're at. You know who the bandits are, who the farmers are, who the samurai are, and you know who's winning and what's happening, who's getting hurt. It must be a really hard thing to do because so many directors fail miserably at it. He shot multicam. He shot with three cameras. Yeah, it was pretty unusual. I don't think it's as unusual now, but directors still rarely do that. But that's how he could do a lot of fast cuts without the action being too sloppy. And he edited his own films. That's important. He directed his films with editing in mind very much, which is probably why he shot multicam, because he knows how much versatility that gives you of cutting exactly where you want, not where you have to, because it's the only place continuity makes sense and it doesn't look muddy. But he also liked to shoot with long lenses to keep the cameras out of the way, which doesn't give you the depth of field, but it gives you that chaos, that claustrophobia that some of those shots have. I don't love action films, but these scenes are just incredible. There's the chaotic scenes. There's also the really well choreographed scenes. He was a master of long takes where he would have characters start far off, get right up close to the camera, and then walk away and let the camera follow them to reveal this completely different scene. And all the while, there's tons of elements taking place, whether it's a fire or it's rain or it's villagers or
the wind rain.
In the trees. Oh,
Kurosawa
rain.
With rain and wind. He was a master of those. Heavy winds, teeming rain. Nobody did that like Kurosawa.
There's a beautiful visual essay on YouTube by this great channel called Every Frame a Painting, and it's called Akira Kurosawa Composing Movement. They do this wonderful job of compiling all these examples of exactly what I'm talking about, and what a great job Kurosawa does of including lots of motion and dynamic scenery in all of his shots, but also composing these beautiful long takes that can tell a story just on their own and are full of tons of beautiful elements, whether it's the set or the actor's performance or the motion in the frame. I really can't recommend it highly enough.
All these things made the movie go over budget.
Oh yeah, did it
way
ever.
Over budget. More than once they stopped filming and he went fishing, and I guess his logic was, well, they've got too much invested in this to actually pull the plug, so we'll shoot again one day. And of course, obviously they did. They were shooting Godzilla, Toho was, at the same time. And we all know how famous that movie is too. Not as influential as Seven Samurai, but it's pretty close.
All the stories about Kurosawa on this film and his career in general just paint him as a Kubrick-esque tyrant on set. He certainly had really high expectations and high demands. He had no regard for budget. He was one of those dictators on set.
An artiste.
Yes.
And it looked what both of those guys produced, because Kurosawa was so prolific. He did Rashomon, Ikiru, which a lot of people rave about. One of his lesser known movies, one of his smaller movies by his scale at least. The list is endless. The guy worked
Yojimbo,
all the damn time.
Kagemusha.
Yeah, Yojimbo is one of the underrated ones. Yeah, 1961. Great movie. And then Eastwood and Sergio Leone did Fistful of Dollars, which originally was going to be called The Magnificent Stranger. And it was based on Yojimbo. And they made the Dollar Trilogy out of that. This is supposed to be the first samurai flick that Kurosawa made. And in doing so, he wrote extensive backstories for the characters with his co-writers Shinobu Hashimoto and Hideo Oguni. Is that right? If I'm doing okay with these names, then that's a miracle. The screenplay probably won't be thought of as the standard of the movie compared to the stylistics, the direction, and the big and smaller performances that are given. And it doesn't help that we're watching it with subtitles, because the subtitles could be banal or even wrong for all we know. But what did you think of the screenplay for such a long movie that tells such an epic story? As you said, though, it was slow in the very beginning.
Dialogue-wise, it's incredibly simple. They really don't say too much.
And maybe that is the adaptation. We don't really know. I have to talk to somebody who's Japanese fluently who could tell us that, I guess.
Well, there doesn't seem to be any more dialogue than there needs to be. And that's not a translation thing. The translation may be good, it may be bad. But there's not dialogue where there doesn't need to be. He can tell a story visually, and every time he can, he does. Another thing that makes him great.
Which is always going to be a cinematic touch. Do it visually if you possibly can.
Which might be another carryover of Japanese culture, too. I think Kabuki is a very visual... Although he goes away from Kabuki. Apparently a lot of Japanese films in the 40s and 50s were very influenced by Kabuki, and so they were very overly stylized. And then he got criticism from Japanese critics for straying away from that so much and making such American films. But the benefit of what he did was that he took something that was incredibly stylized and phony and did something that was this natural.
By having people like Kanbe be the offset to the over-the-top guy, maybe that's part of why it worked. That's the thing we learned from Howard Hawks. He talked about how in Bringing Up Baby, everyone's nuts, even Cary Grant's character. So when he did His Girl Friday, Cary Grant's the anchor. And I suppose Rosalind Russell is too, compared to most of the characters in that picture. But when you've got the anchor compared to the people who are nuts, well, of course, in this case, it is Mifune versus Shimura, that's the balance, I suppose.
The original script was 6 samurai, and they actually added Mifune. They cast Mifune as, maybe it was Kanba, I can't remember who they cast him as, but they recast him as the crazy character because they had to add a crazy character because they thought the samurai, all honor, were boring. So they needed to do something to just liven it up, and that's why they wrote his character.
And the most fun that they ever have in this movie, the only real laughs are from him. Those guys laughing at him, sometimes with him. There's the great scene where he's trying to ride the horses. He never can seem to master horse riding, including going behind a structure, and he's on the horse, but barely, and then it comes out, the horse is first, and he's running after it. Wait, wait for me! Stop! Come back!
But he doesn't pull his punches when him and the other funny, goofy character both buy it. As a matter of fact, the other funny, goofy, smiley character is the first of the samurai to die when they raid the village. He individually tries to be a hero by saving the farmer who goes after his wife, running into the burning building, and then they all die.
All right, well, the movie is 1:37:1. Of course, it's black and white, and it's got some subtitles on there, unless you speak Japanese, you can kill those. The Criterion DVD, pretty spotty.
Yeah, what a terrible print for a Criterion. It was very disappointing.
I'm not sure if there's a Blu-ray of this. Hopefully, if there is, it's better, but the Criterion is not good at all.
And the features stank. There was nothing to
just
it.
Just a commentary.
Come on, guys.
Criterion, get on with it.
Like, at least do a dirt pass. I used to do dirt passes when I was an assistant, and I know they're not fun, but I know they aren't that pricey either. You could have paid an intern to spend a few weeks doing a dirt pass on this film.
Cinematographer shooting this movie that doesn't look very good anymore, at least on our DVD, Asakazu Nakai. And if I got that right, then another gold star for me. He is one of the many Kurosawa regulars, including the producer Sajiro Motoki. The editor was Kurosawa himself, editing by himself. Such a long movie, that's impressive. He worked late at night. Kevin Smith has done that for a lot of his movies in recent times. Not to compare Kevin Smith to Kurosawa, but when you edit your own pictures during the production late at night, you can show either the investors or your producer or the cast and crew, if you want to, what we've got so far, and that people can get an idea of what they have to do for the rest of the shoot.
Yeah, you can also determine, oh, the scene would be perfect if we just had this shot. Well, we're still on set, we still have the actors, still have the costumes, let's get that shot tomorrow on set.
Rather than reshooting, which is what modern action films, especially more than most other movies, almost always have a couple weeks of reshoots, and then all the dirt sheets in Hollywood will go crazy. They're doing reshoots, the movie must stink. Often it does, but that's become a standard thing in Hollywood. One of the great stories about that would be Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, won Best Picture, and a few months later they were shooting pickup shots for the special edition DVD that came out later that same year, and Peter Jackson thought that was ironic. We've already won all the Oscars we can possibly win for this movie, and yet they're still shooting the movie.
Well, it was quite unprecedented at the time. It's still pretty unusual for a director to edit their own film, but he loved editing. As a matter of fact, he often said that he shot a film simply in order to have material to edit because the editing of a picture was the most important and creatively interesting part of the process for him. And he's been called by many one of the greatest editors of all time. He's obviously a great director, but I think it speaks to the benefit of directing with the editing process in mind. It's incredibly fluid. And yes, I have a problem with the first hour. I think it drags. I think it could have been
it's
shorter.
It's a leisurely pace in this movie, for sure.
You could say that. Although they'll get there. No complaints. Once they're all in the village, it's great. I have no complaints about the length. I don't feel like it drags at all. I wouldn't take anything out.
The vignettes they show are important for character development by that point. It is early on, but it's even more important when they get to the village.
It just works better. It's not as boring, to be honest. But when it comes to the action or even the slow scenes, he's just a perfect editor. You could use it to teach class. Of course, it's helpful when the editor is also the person deciding what's going to end up on film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, much like Alfred Hitchcock would shoot everything perfectly, exactly how he wanted to be edited. If you're a director that's that conscientious, then it's probably an easier part of the job. But I find it refreshing and have lots of respect for a director that honors that process above all else. Because, of course, I'm an editor, so it's my favorite.
What about the technical use of editing devices in the film? The wipes. And again, George Lucas used that in the Star Wars movies.
The 50s, it was a super unusual thing to do. Like, it was common in the silent films, but by that time they had dropped it. So it's hard for me to judge it as a technique because you still see it lots now, and there's so much more cultural context to it. Like the Star Wars films, it doesn't really stick out to me. It doesn't feel that unusual. Perhaps credit to Kurosawa for inspiring George Lucas to put it in some of the most popular films ever made so that it doesn't strike you as strange anymore.
It can be such an arty way to get from one scene to another if you do it right, and I think that Lucas did quite well in the Star Wars movies.
I think it speaks to the technique of using a bold transition to really snap the audience out of a scene and say, we're moving on to something significantly different now.
Contrast to Ozu, who, if I recall, did cuts exclusively, or at least mostly, probably exclusively, and Kubrick did those slow dissolves from one scene to another. Where you'd see the guy on screen or the woman on screen for a long time as it goes to the next scene. And if you watch the documentary, The Making of The Shining, well, the one, Room 237, we talked about that when we did The Shining many months ago in the Not 100 Project, all those people, their crackpot theories, but some of those actually have relevance where there's a shot in the next coming scene that actually matches up with the previous scene.
Yeah, it's very intentional. You have a slow dissolve. You want to draw the audience's attention to the comparison between the original shot and the new shot that's coming in.
Or in Godfather Part 2, where you can have Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, who are many years apart in the movie, De Niro playing the young Vito, and then Michael playing the modern version in 1974 of Michael Corleone, and you can have them on the screen at the same time for a few seconds by doing it that way. Okay, the composer was Fumio Hayasaka. And he also worked a lot with Kurosawa. So we're seeing this kind of theme. We saw this a lot in the podcast we've done through the Top Runner Project and beyond, that directors use the same people over and over again behind the scenes with their composers, the editors, cinematographers, and often the producers and some of the main actors. I don't recall the music being all that much of a standout, but it was probably sort of a Japanese culture kind of thing. Maybe it's supposed to be based on the 16th century, so I wouldn't recognize that anyway as a boring old 21st century white Canadian.
Well, it wasn't distracting, so credit to them that it adds without calling attention to itself.
And that's a bad thing, because you've hated music so often in our podcasts. I think we've covered most of the influence already, the Magnificent Seven, of course. Also the 2016 remake of Magnificent Seven, which comes out, I guess, in the fall. I think it's the fall. Denzel Washington will play the main character, and then Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, and I think also Vincent D'Onofrio are in this one. So I'm going to see it. I'm a fan of Mag 7. I'm a fan of Seven Samurai.
And while we're talking about influence, possibly one of the most important ways this film and Kurosawa in general influences, all you have to do is look at the list of directors who consider him one of their favorites and consider his film a lesson in how to make films. And we already talked about George Lucas, but the list is Ingmar Bergman, Steven Spielberg, Fellini, Polanski, Werner Herzog, Altman, Coppola, Scorsese, Miyazaki, Alexander Payne, Guillermo del Toro, Catherine Bigelow, J.J. Abrams, Inarritu, Spike Lee, and I'm sure the list goes on, but those are some incredibly impressive
Who are those
names.
People? What do they know about movies? Losers all. He probably is as influential as anybody, other than maybe John Ford and Hitchcock in the history of movies.
I keep saying he's a technical master. If I was teaching a class on film where I just wanted to teach people the proper way to make a film, I would use his work as examples over and over.
And you're thinking about Rashomon also, which I know you've seen.
Yeah,
not
yeah,
just
seen,
Seven Samurai.
Yeah, I've seen, this is the fourth of this film. I hadn't seen Seven Samurai before this, but I have seen other Kurosawa films before. Most of them while I was in film school. So credit to my teachers for deciding to teach us with Kurosawa films. I agree with their choice. I think he is a great instructor on how to do things right. He doesn't break the rules. I mean, he made the rules, but he made the right rules. And he doesn't bend them too much. He just knows how to make something perfectly.
The other influences are other Ronin films and the old let's put a team together action movies, because as we see in the movie, you see one by one, he adds to the group to make it better and stronger. and also Mistaken Identity Hired Gun Films, Three Amigos, the underrated comedy from the 80s, A Bug's Life, I mentioned already, and Galaxy Quest. When I was reading online, I thought, that's true. I love Galaxy Quest, but they are hired, well, they're not really hired, but by the aliens to fight somebody off when they are imposters. They're not imposters in Seven Samurai, but they're hired to take on the bad guys, and they, spoiler alert, win. All right, the awards and list section is extremely short. Two nominations at the 1956 Oscars for the sets and the costumes. It didn't win either one of them. And as I said before, Kurosawa was only nominated once for directing, and it was 1985 for Ron. He didn't win. That went to Sidney Pollack for Out of Africa, a movie I've never seen twice and probably never will.
Hey, just for the record, it was a hit in Japan, wasn't it?
It took a while, but I think it was actually a slowly but surely building hit. Well, it took a while actually to make its money back, so I should say, because it cost a lot to make because of all the delays.
At the time, the most expensive film ever made in Japan. I think it was $500,000 at the time.
And then Godzilla from the same studio did pretty well. Gojira? Did pretty well, too. But I think that also was one of those that was not cheap, but they both paid off handsomely for Toho Studios, or Toho Pictures, whatever the hell they called it. Okay, before we wrap up the podcast, we've got a few Turner Classic Movie recommendations to make, and we're going to have even more when we do next week with Stand By Me. But here's some movies that we've covered before that we recommend you watch on Turner Classic Movies if you don't already have the DVD or Blu-ray. Frankenstein is on at 8 p.m. on August 26th, and then Bride of Frankenstein follows right after that on the same night. Not a great movie in Bev's eyes, and a good one in my case, Frankenstein. Very influential, though, at the very least, Frankenstein.
It just hasn't aged well. I'm sure it's an incredible movie, or was an incredible movie in the 30s, but it looks its age.
Well, that'll be on the weekend upcoming. The Great Escape, which we only covered a few months ago, is on at 8 p.m. on August 27th. And then Shane is on again. It's been on a few times in the last few months, at 2 p.m. on August 28th, the day before our next podcast.
Shane, come back!
So check those out, or just buy the Blu-rays, especially in the case of Shane and Great Escape. All right, so final thoughts on Seven Samurai, one of the all-time greats, and we had to cover it as long as it was. We had to make time for it. Luckily, we were on vacation, and you weren't feeling that well, so we had 3.5 hours to burn through. But go ahead.
Well, I was way overdue in finally seeing this classic. It's hard to exaggerate the impact it had on cinema, or the impact it still has on us, the viewer.
And if you haven't seen the other ones I mentioned, like Rashomon, Throne of Blood, check those out, too. Rashomon may be more so than any other Kurosawa picture. This is his greatest, but that might be his best, if you know what I'm talking about there. The Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb thing. Who's the greatest ball player? Who's the best ball player?
I think that being a crowd pleaser should be taken into account when considering whether a film is good or not.
True.
Many would disagree with me, but I think being entertaining and pleasing to the viewer, you know, should be counted.
The one point against this movie, though, is that it is a little bit too long, and we've always talked about that, where movies do feel like they're too long sometimes, and this one does, partly because it takes a long time for it to get anywhere in the very beginning. And then who wants to read a movie if they don't have to? I'm gonna sound like I'm 50 years old, but it's true.
The pace really reminded me of all those David Lean epics we watched when we were going through the AFI list.
Yeah, the high points in Lawrence of Arabia especially are as good as it gets, but the movie does have some real dead points. Prisoner Requiem has a lot fewer dead points than Dr. Zhivago or Lawrence of Arabia, doesn't it?
Again, it has a pretty slow start, though. It's a real slow build before it becomes incredible and my favorite of the three epics that we did cover, but I recall it took a while for it to win me over.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, well, these long movies, they really want you to invest some paying attention time, if you will, and modern movies, more often than not, are not 3.5 hours long. They might be 2.5 hours long, and they often are, but a lot of them don't deserve that time either, and we don't really care about the characters as much as we're supposed to. But this movie has that bittersweet ending. We won, but we lost. Not many movies today will ever go down that road. Even Lord of the Rings, which does kind of go down that road, almost everybody we care about is still alive when it's all said and done.
It's a beautifully complex depth to the film.
Yeah. Okay, and Seven Sunrises on the next 100 project. We return to North America and tackle a classic from our youth, and it's also less than half as long a movie as Seven Samurai. It's Rob Reiner's coming-of-age com-drama, Stand By Me. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for Stand By Me. We know River Phoenix died young, so of course he made the fewest movies of any of the main cast in Stand By Me. Which of the other three boys have, to date, the most acting credits in movies? Or does their director, Rob Reiner, have more acting credits than all of them?
That's a great question, because the three of them went on to pretty different careers, really. Okay, so for the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's podcast for Stand By Me. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, please rate us and review us. Also, while you're there, check out our 170-ish other podcasts. Everything is still available free on iTunes. All those podcasts include all 123 movies that were covered on the AFI's 1998 or 2007 Best of lists, as well as many other titles that Ryan and I chose to cover just because we wanted to.
Including one other foreign film, Wages of Fear. We've got two now on our
roster. Two whole foreign films. So lots of stuff to choose from there. I guarantee you're going to find movies that you like. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
Arigato for listening.
Domo arigato. And cut.